17, which is the budget bill for the Department of Environmental Quality. And we will continue with the agency program and services detail presentation with the Water Quality Division. And I will call forward all of the folks who want to come and talk to us about water quality. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Stephanie Halleck, the Director of the Department of Environmental Quality. And with me today is Helen Lottridge, the Administrator of the Management Services Division, and Mike Llewellyn, who is the Administrator of the Water Quality Division. And we will be at tab 5 in the DEQ presentation notebook. And again, these tabs are organized into 3 sections. I'll start with a program overview, and then I will do a budget overview for water, and then there's some supplemental information at the end of the tab. The water quality program purpose is to ensure that all Oregon waters are fishable, drinkable, and swimmable. We do that basically by setting water quality standards, and then we assign load allocations, and then we regulate to limit discharges, and then we assess whether or not those standards are being met. We have the federal programs under the Clean Water Act delegated to run in this state. We are delegated authorization for those programs by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. And some of the key elements of that program that we operate, of course, we have several activities associated with the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, which is a state initiative. We also set standards and do water quality assessments, as I said. We have a large wastewater control program, and we are asking for a fee increase in that program, which includes our permitting and compliance activity, pre-treatment program, biosolids, operator certification for sewage treatment plants. We have a fee increase associated with that. Our on-site septic tank program. We also give grants and loans in the water program. The loan program is a state revolving fund. We have groundwater protection program and, of course, the National Estuary Project. So there's a lot of activity in the water program. Our water quality priorities that we've been focusing on, of course, the first on the list you'll see are getting the total maximum daily loads set for the streams that are on the what is called the 303D list, which refers to the section of the Clean Water Act that lists stream segments in which we have pollution problems, and we have a 2007 deadline for those. We are hopeful that we will have approval for our fee increase to add staff in our permitting program so that we can eliminate our permit backlog. It would take us about 5 years to do that. We currently have about a 33% permit backlog, and I'll be talking more about that in the future and in this presentation. We're also partnering with the Oregon Health Division and communities to conduct assessments of all the public drinking water sources, and we have a package in here for that that we'll discuss. I've listed performance measures on this sheet, but I'd like to come back to that. I have some graphics to go over with you with regard to those and a couple more overheads. Some of the accomplishments in the current biennium, we have made a good start on doing the TMDLs. We're of course working on 91 sub-basins. We've completed, I think, 154 TMDLs on various stream segments. We're on a pretty tight time frame for the TMDLs on the Willamette in particular, and we do have a policy package that continues the resource for that work. And we'll be talking about that when I get to the policy packages. We have administered about $2.7 million in grants for non-point source projects and about $43.6 million in low-interest loans. That's our state revolving fund loans to municipalities for sewage treatment plant upgrades. We gave you some information, I believe, on the Lapine demonstration project for new on-site sewage systems. We're very pleased to be one of 3 national demonstration projects that were funded by the federal government, and that project is moving along, and we're asking to continue that project also. We have made some improvements in our on-site program in terms of office hours and the response time. We've shortened that down to a couple of weeks. When we were up, I think last session when I spoke to you, to 3 to 5 weeks on some of our on-site actions, and we have now have full-time staff in both Baker City and Warrenton to keep our some smaller offices open and on-site. So we were pleased to be able to do that with the fee increase that you approved last session for us in on-site. I am going to talk in a minute about the surface water quality and when I discuss performance measures. And we've also provided inventories of risk and assessment reports on the public drinking water supplies. That's part of that effort I mentioned a moment ago, and we do have a package associated with that. And finally, we, under Mike's direction, the program has been working hard on implementing some efficiencies in tracking our permits and our time accounting and that sort of thing. In the water program, I want to talk just a moment about the sources of pollution. The traditional regulatory framework for most of our programs, both in water and air, were around point sources and the discharges from either industrial sources or municipal sources to surface water primarily, although we do regulate discharges that are potentially going to groundwater as well. The type of pollutant depends on what the plant does or what, whether or not it's a municipal wastewater system. There is, however, as I'm sure you've heard when you've been discussing the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, increasing interest in and emphasis upon non-point source discharges. And those are urban stormwater runoff discharges, discharges from construction activities. They can be from either timber harvesting or some agricultural practices, and that's why we have the Forest Practices Act and also Senate Bill 1010. We partner with Department of Forestry and Department of Ag when we work on the TMDLs to include those plans. And there are also some activities that indirectly, if you will, affect water quality, the flows, flow releases from the dams, in some cases where there's been vegetation stripped from the sides of streams that can contribute either to sedimentation or to loss of shade. And then also, as we have increased drawdown on groundwater, that can actually affect surface water as well. I do want to talk a little bit now about the performance measures on the next slide, and I'm going to ask Greg Pettit, who you have seen before. He's the acting administrator of the laboratory. He's also our water quality monitoring section manager in the lab, and he's going to come up and we'll talk about the trends in surface water quality. This, and we have a handout for you as well. Has this been given to Ken? Okay. This overhead that you see on the screen, there's two pieces of information. One is the percentage of monitored stream sites with water quality in good to excellent condition, and the percentage of monitored stream sites with significantly improving trends in water quality, and these are from the Oregon benchmarks. Let me explain the data gap before we go on. Actually, the lab has data for the years that you don't see a bar chart for. They simply have not put the information together. They did a baseline year, and the benchmarks kicked in 95, so they went immediately into keeping track to meet the benchmark commitment, and they haven't yet had time to go back and fill in the gaps on the data. So that's why there's a gap on those overhead. As you can see in the text I provided, DEQ monitors water quality 158 sites in rivers and streams across the state, and we use a water quality index to evaluate the status and trends in water quality from those sites. And I'll just let Greg maybe talk a little bit about the data and what's going on with water quality, and maybe walk through the handout that was just provided also.
The indicator that we use for measuring water quality was selected so we can tell if basically our programs are getting better or worse. It's based upon trends at our water quality monitoring sites. As Stephanie stated, we have 158 ambient monitoring sites around the state, and these sites were selected to provide coverage of all the major rivers in the state. There's about 52,000 miles of streams in the state, but of those 52,000 miles, only about 7,000 are larger streams. The remaining miles are what are called first and third order streams, and those are generally small, wadable streams. So these ambient monitoring sites represent one site for about every 50 miles of major rivers in the state. So taken in whole, they give a pretty good coverage of the major streams in the state. And the data from each one of these sites is looked at for a 10-year period. We use the Water Quality Index, and we perform a trending analysis on the data from each site. So the graphs that you see represent the aggregated trends from all of those sites. And as Stephanie explained, we started actually calculating and reporting on the benchmark in 1995. So we went back and calculated for the period from 1980 to 1990. That's what's represented by 1990. And then each one of these years thereafter where you see the results, that represents a 10-year period. So the majority of the sites in the state are showing an improvement in water quality. Our most recent trending analysis, we had 64% of the monitored sites had improving water quality. We only had one site that had a declining water quality, and that site was South Fork of the McKenzie River, which happens to be the site that has the highest overall ranking of water quality within the state. And the decrease there was quite small.
So it had nowhere to go but down?
That was kind of the case in that one, yes, that's correct. And then the other benchmark that's at the top there, that's the percentage of streams that are in good to excellent condition. The Water Quality Index is broken down. We've broken it down to describe streams as either excellent, good, fair, poor, or very poor. And I'd like at this time to talk a little bit about the handout that I provided. On the second page of the handout is a map which shows where our monitoring sites are around the state. And on that map, we have them color-coded in terms of their overall water quality status. That's based upon 10 years worth of data collection. And then the arrows indicate whether or not water quality is getting better or worse at those sites. If there's no arrow or other figure on that site, then there is not a significant trend. As you can see, most of the sites do have improving water quality trends. And there's some technical information in here that you may or may not find interesting, but the main reason I wanted to hand this out and let you have it was because Table 3 provides a list of those sites that do have trends, the first improving trends, and it gives the magnitude of those trends. And by looking at that, you can see that the greatest number of sites that have improving water quality trends and those sites that have the greatest magnitude in water quality improvements are sites where we're currently implementing our TMDL program, where a TMDL has been adopted and the management plan is being implemented. There's the table on the declining sites is table 4, just the one site. And then tables 5 provide a ranking of all the sites that we monitor in the state. And many people find it interesting to look at the different rivers around the state, the monitoring sites that we have, and how those sites relate to each other overall in terms of water quality. And then finally, the last table, table 10, I believe it is the same sites, simply organized by the basin that they're in.
Okay. And then the only other thing I've included on this overhead is the reasons that we believe that water quality is improving. As Greg said, the fact that we are getting the TMDLs completed and they are having an impact. Of course, the wastewater permit program that has been around for quite some time to regulate the discharges from the industrial and municipal sources has had an effect over time. And also the activities under the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, that the various watershed councils and the people in the communities are getting involved and taking actions in their own areas have definitely helped. The stormwater program, which is relatively new, started with the larger municipalities and will be including some smaller ones. And also, I did note on here that weather, of course, has an impact. And we are involved with several other agencies, both state and federal, in discussions about the potential impacts of a drought this year and what might be happening to water quality when we get to the end of the summer. And so obviously that makes a difference to us whether or not we have snowpack and rain in terms of water quality. The next graph is also has to do with a performance measure was on this handout. The percent of wastewater discharge permits issued within the target time period or less. Before we get into the performance measure, what this graph will show you is basically that we have had, since 1990, a fairly sharp increase in the number of active sources in water quality. We issue both federal permits under EPA's National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, commonly referred to as NPDES permits, which are basically just the federal water permits. We have about 2,500 of those. And then we have water pollution control facility permits, which are issued by the state, and we have about 1,300 of those. The difference between those two kinds of permits is that the federal permits are issued to dischargers where it is known that there will be a discharge to surface water, and it will limit the pollution allowed. The water pollution control facility, or WPCF permits, are issued if they are discharging into a lagoon system or in some way not discharging, so there is no discharge to surface water. There's a fair number, as you can imagine, of those WPCF permits in eastern Oregon where there's not a lot of surface water to discharge to, and they have other ways of dealing with the wastewater.
Stephanie, what happens as over the summer and into the fall we get into these real low water situations that we're anticipating? How does that impact the, I mean, imagine what it'll end up doing is lowering the quality of water that's in the streams and in the rivers. Will that mean that the next bar is going to be a much shorter bar because the water quality will be lower? How does that all factor in with how you measure it?
Madam Chair, I'm going to let Mike get in on this and perhaps Greg as well, but basically the possibility that you outlined could exist. I mean, water quality could be degraded depending on the severity of the situation. What we would hope to try, in many cases where streams are already listed as being polluted for some reason, we're trying to get the dischargers out of the streams already. In other parts of this building, there is a lot of discussion about land application of wastewater. I don't know if any of you have been privy to those, but that's a very good option where you can have treated effluent be land applied to grow crops if it's done at agronomic rates and public health and the environment are protected. So we try and get folks out of the streams where possible. And I'll let Mike jump in and talk a little bit about what happens if their discharge may be in violation and how we deal with those situations.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Mike Llewellyn, Administrator of the Water Quality Division. Stephanie's correct that there are a lot of dischargers who have a discharge into surface waters during the winter and spring, and then in summer they actually physically transport their surface water discharge to land because of the phenomenon that in most years the amount of water that's left in the streams in the summer and early fall is such that the amount of discharge that would otherwise go into it would cause a water quality problem. From a legal standpoint, however, we do acknowledge in our permits that at some point, if the natural flow is in the stream goes down because of a drought, as long as the permittee is meeting the conditions in their permit, they're not liable for water quality standards violations in the stream. That accounts for that natural variation in surface water quantity.
Thank you.
But we, again, we are, and we just at Cabinet had a discussion about low flow. Paul Cleary made a presentation with some others about what it doesn't look too good in the Willamette Basin in particular in terms of how much water is going to be. Now, maybe this week's been a pretty good week. We'll see. And maybe it'll get better, but it could be problematic.
We have spring break and Rose Festival left.
To rain.
Yeah.
But the main reason I wanted to show you this graph is to show the permitting workload, the number increase in number of sources. This is the program for which we're requesting a fee increase, and I will discuss that more. The tasks are listed on here that staff will do, which is to write permits, both new and renewals. And I think this subject came up in AIR, and one of the things I wanted to point out is there's no rule about this, but the general policy of the department with regard to permitting is that new sources take precedence. We're very aware of economic development implications of folks needing to open an industry or whatever, and we attempt to get to the new permit requests just as quickly as we can, and also major modifications. But there is a huge backlog in this program, about a 33%, and I will talk about that in the future.
And when you say 33%, are you saying that one-third of the applications in the system are behind schedule?
Madam Chair, yes. Basically, the way the statute is written, when the permit's written for 10 years or 5 years?
5 years.
5 years. And the way the statute is written, if the permit expires before we've gotten around to officially renew it, it is still technically a legal permit. So nobody is operating illegally. It's just that we've not had the time or the staff to get in and review the permit, see if any changes need to be made to update it. So they operate under their old permit. So this basically, that 33% means that of the roughly 38 or 3,900 sources in water quality, 33% of those are beyond their expiration date and they need to get looked at and their permit needs to be revisited. But they're not operating illegally. I want to make sure that that's clear.
So are there things that you're doing to revise the process that as was done in the air quality side of things to make the process more efficient?
Madam Chair, there are. Mike can get into detail about that. We haven't gotten quite as far as the air quality program, but Mike has initiated some of those same activities. We've also, part of the budget request for the fee increase and the new resources does take into account some of these process improvements, but it also, this program, water quality, I've been at the department 12 years, and it's been underfunded ever since I've been there. I mean, they have never caught up to the work. And EPA has finally done a workload model, and we'll talk about it in a little bit, but it basically shows to run a program the size of Oregon's and to do the work, it would take about 68 FTE. There's currently 56 in the program, hence we're asking for more. But Mike can tell you a little bit some of the process improvements that he's initiated already.
Madam Chair, as Stephanie said, the issue of an NPDES permit backlog has been plaguing most water quality agencies in the country since the beginning of the Clean Water Act. It's just been, there's a number of reasons for that. One is, as you can see just visually, the growth in the number of permits over the last 10 years, which is not unusual for any state to be looking at that same type of an upward graph, simply has not equated to having the resources to keep up with that volume of work. So EPA itself has been looking, particularly in the last 3 or 4 years, at process improvements themselves, because a lot of what we have to do is just following EPA requirements. But that aside, we did, starting in May of this year, the same thing the AIR program had done over the past couple of years, which is to bring together a number of our senior permit writers, people who've been doing this business and this job for a number of years, and had that work group sit down with a specialist in basically process improvement, identify from their standpoint what are the internal problems associated with the lack of efficiency or effectiveness in the permit writing process. They identified a very common theme, which is that they just need more upgraded tool development. And some examples that I can give you is that until very recently, every time a permit writer drafted a permit, they were doing it from scratch. They started basically with the drafting of the verbiage, the conditions that were in permits, looking up data from different data sources, and writing a permit. From the very beginning, the manager then sat down and had to review the permit to make sure that it met state and federal requirements. We developed what we call the Permit Wizard, which is essentially a template for a permit that has some menus associated with it so that the permit writer can go in and say, well, this is a typical municipal permit or a typical electroplater permit, and find the standard conditions that would apply to any of those particular categories. It also allows the manager to know that they don't need to review every line of that permit because they've already seen the standard conditions. So just using basic technology, information technology, for our permit writers, we've been able to develop these tools that will allow them much quicker access to information that they need. So most of the initial process improvement recommendations were very internally focused for how can we make the job of a permit manager easier. The next phase that we want to get into this summer is to go external. talk more with the permittees about the interaction between the agency and the permittees, because we do know that one of the biggest time sinks to get a permit out the door are the number of iterations that we go through back and forth between us and the permittee on data, did their consultant provide the right information to us, etc. So we want to talk to the permittee universe about how can we clarify expectations of submitting an application to us that doesn't have to be kicked back to them because of a miscommunication or bad data. See if we can do some of this electronically as well. So right now our primary emphasis has been on the internal part of permit writing, but we intend to go external this summer as well.
Representative Krieger.
Chair Morgan, your chart trends in the number of permit sources. I got here a little bit late, but definitely up. What percentage would you say, or do you have any way of knowing, how many of those are within the Willamette watershed basin and the lower part where we're having problems, supersite and on up the river?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, there's out of that about 3,800 permit total, about 1,400 of those permits are in the Willamette Basin. I could, if you'd like, get a breakout by sub-basin within the Willamette, such as the Yamhill or the Malala, but 1,400 of the total state permits are in the Willamette.
Follow up. Would you say they're the average size permit, or are they larger because of larger companies, larger development?
Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, clearly in the Willamette, when you look at our municipal universe, all of the larger municipal permits are in the Willamette. When you think about Eugene and Salem and Portland, and also a large number of the larger industry permits that we deal with in this state are in the Willamette Basin as well.
Thank you.
How long is a water quality permit good for?
Madam Chair, under the federal regulations, they're good for 5 years, and then they have to be reissued after 5 years.
And then there must be some other process that if you substantially change whatever it's you're doing, you have to go in and have the permit changed too?
That's correct, Madam Chair. That's called a permit modification.
Are you looking at any options like having the kinds of standard permits that have been introduced into the air quality side? Is that an applicable concept to this program?
Yes, Madam Chair. Actually, the air program took after us because we actually use a large number of those permits are general permits, meaning that they're a generic permit for a particular industrial sector. The downside to a general permit usually comes from the entity itself, who believes that they have some different configuration of their system or their process that doesn't match the general permit, but they can always come to us for an individual permit. But we've got quite a few, almost over 1,000 general permits that cover different types of categories. So I think that we've used that tool quite well.
Are those permits also involved in the backlog? I mean, I'm real curious about what exactly is in this backlog.
Madam Chair, most of the backlog permits are actually the individual permits, because when we reissue, as an example, the stormwater construction erosion permit, which is a general permit, when we reissue that every 5 years, there's probably 1,000 general stormwater permits that are covered by that particular category, so they immediately all become current. So most of the backlog is actually the individual permits for cities and industries that's causing that 33% figure.
And then inside that subset, what you've identified is that what slows the process down there is all the backing and forthing of the language and the requirements?
Madam Chair, that's one example. I think there are many systemic issues around NPDES permits and why they're backlogged. One other example is that at least for the last 25 to 30 years, most state water quality agencies have focused on what we call major permits, and those are the large municipal and large industrial permits. They tend to turn over their conditions quite a bit, either because EPA has promulgated new regulations for those large facilities, or the facilities, because of their very nature, tend to change their production and their processes quite frequently. So they come to us, even though they may have a current permit, 2 years into having a new five-year permit with a production change, that causes us usually to, as Stephanie mentioned, to respond to that need. And we don't really get credit for that because it's not showing up as a permit production. But that's just another systemic example of why we have a 33% permit.
If I came in and needed to have my permit amended because I was doing something differently in my operation, and you didn't get to the permit in the time frame, would I still fall into the place where my old permit would govern my activities?
Madam Chair, if I understand your question, if you change production and that caused you to increase the amount of pollutant loading coming out of your pipe, and we had not reflected that in a new permit, you would be violating your current permit. If your production change really didn't impact what you discharged necessarily, then you'd be okay under your current permit. So really, Matt, what's important to you as a facility in terms of requesting a modification is, are you changing something at your operation that would increase the amount of pollution coming out of your pipe? And would that increase be covered under your current permit or not? And if it's not, then you'd want us to revise that permit pretty quickly, because otherwise you'd be liable.
So at that point, it's critical to deal with those revisions so that the permittees are not out of compliance.
That's correct, Madam Chair. As Stephanie said, that's how we operate. So if the permit, we have several permits that may be 7 or 8 years old, even some that are 10 years old. And the reason that we have not updated those is because they are still operating within their current permit limitations. And we do try to respond to the folks who would otherwise not be able to meet their permit conditions because of process change.
So if my permit expires but I'm not doing anything differently, I've got a real low priority in the system and it just keeps kind of going along. If my permit expires or I change my process and I'm doing things differently, then my permit gets put on the top layer and gets worked through the system. So what would be my incentive as a permittee to change that system?
Well, Madam Chair, one of the flip side of that is that some of the permits that may be 7 or 8 years old, even though the permittee is fine with having that permit, their environmental conditions may be such that they're causing a water quality problem. They may be still living with an old permit that has old conditions in it, but we may not have addressed toxics in their discharge because we haven't touched their permit in 7 or 8 years. They're okay legally because they're meeting their current permit, but from an environmental standpoint, there's a problem in the water column or the sediment because of that old permit. So it's really more our motivation to try to get those permits updated as well.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you say our motivation, are there federal obligations that we have that would motivate us? And opportunity. I mean, if we have a permittee who is using up some of the capacity of a stream, wouldn't there be some advantage to other would-be permittees in our modernizing that so that we could allow more activity on that stream?
Madam Chair and Representative Nolan, absolutely. As an example, if a stream is listed on the 303D list, we cannot, until we do a TMDL, we cannot allow any new or increased discharges to that same stream segment. So you're correct that's one ramification of not catching up on the backlog. I might also say that there has been some case law recently where a third-party litigation can be brought against a discharger for, even though they're meeting their permit condition, if the water quality standards are being violated, they are, and there's a cause and effect that can be drawn between those, the permittee and the water quality standards violation, they can be held liable for that problem. So there is motivation for them to also update their permit.
Madam Chair, Representative Nolan, this ties into a point that I wanted to make about this permitting business. This is not just a piece of paper that one sort of stamps and gives you and you're on your way. These permits, particularly the individual permits, are incredibly complex. And you can get, and I, are given a current example, you can be working with a source like we are in our northwest region with the Blue Heron pulp mill on the Willamette River, an enormously complex permit, enormously controversial issues, and probably three full FTE in that region have been eaten up over the last year working on that one permit. I mean, that's one of the problems that with these permits. It is not necessarily a precise science. I mean, the whole business of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act from the get-go is figuring it's not a zero, those are not zero discharge laws. They might tell you they are, but they're not. They are laws that allow you to divide up the airshed or the watershed as to how much each individual contributor can put in there. It's very difficult to figure that out. And the roadmaps are not precise. And so this permit work is time-consuming for a reason. Yes, there are process improvements. There's no question about that. But even with those, when you get into some of these huge sources and these enormously complex issues, it just takes a really long time. With that, I would move into talking about TMDLs a little bit. This overhead you see up there is also, if you flip to the next page, is the larger, it should be, I hope, page 46 in your book, if we've got the same page numbering here, is the big map, so you can see all the sub-basins. And this is the schedule that we're on for doing these total maximum daily lows. And again, what that means in real terms is that you have a water body, a surface water, and it has what is referred to as an assimilative capacity. It can handle so much pollution. And what you're doing when you're setting a total maximum daily load is you're figuring out incrementally how much pollution from various sources of different kinds of pollutants that stream segment can handle. So this load allocation business, again, is complex. It's done using a lot of modeling and actual data, of course. But we have 1,153 stream segments that we are working on doing the TMDLs for, 91 sub-basins, and we are under a deadline of 2007 to complete that work. And as I said, we've done 154. And the Willamette, by the way, I think last session this day, by the provision of additional resources, we have an accelerated deadline of 2003 to complete the Willamette Basin. We do partner with a lot of other agencies, and we do work with EPA. EPA has provided us resources for this this effort. We're always dealing with lawsuits of one kind or another, either threatened or actual, and so we are very mindful of the circumstances that those might engender. But I did want you to see kind of a picture of which TMDLs are supposed to be done when, and Mike can talk in detail. We've done the Grand Ronde in northeast Oregon, we've done the Umatilla, we've done the Tualatin, the South Fork of the Coquille just went out. Something on the Umpqua, I don't know, I have them all memorized, I'm sure you do.
That's it.
So we're working away at it, but it's highly labor-intensive, and we're still optimistic we're going to make 2007, but it's tough work. And we do have, by the way, advisory councils in every basin. We just started a new council in the Willamette. Who's the chair? Do you know who that is, by any chance? I just went to a kickoff meeting for them, but we work with the Senate Bill 1010 local advisory committees on the agricultural component of the TMDL. The Forest Practices Act is the umbrella for the forestry aspects of any of our TMDLs. So they're pretty comprehensive.
Anyone would like to jump in on TMDLs here? This one, I think, is especially for the people that have served on the Salmon Committee and the policy committees, a real can of worms. And it's a real frustrating program to try to figure out how it's going to get wired in ultimately with all the other existing programs that we have to save salmon and do all the other things that we want to do in the environment. And I think that there's a lot of us that are really watching with great curiosity how this is ultimately going to be implemented. I know that when we did the 10-10 egg water quality management plan on the Umpqua drainage over the interim, one of the things that came out was that a lot of the 303D listed streams down there, as in the whole of Oregon, are listed for temperature, and that the listings are based on one temperature reading at the bottom of a reach and one that's, you know, a whole bunch of miles up at the top of the reach. And based on those two readings, which one of them was quite often done by the BLM or the Forest Service, and one of them may have been done by the DEQ, and the conditions that they were done under were quite different. It was really frustrating to see how spotty the data was, and just to see how frustrated people became with how streams got listed in that process and the paucity of the data that was used. So I think as we work our way through this, there are going to be a lot of policy issues that are going to cause a lot of spark points between the rural legislators and this program.
Madam Chair, I totally understand what you're saying, and I also appreciate your kindness in discussing the issue of temperature, which I know is highly volatile and emotional issue. Ever since the standard was set 6 years ago, or however many years ago it's been now, I would say in the water program about 90% of the dialogue in that program is about the temperature standard. There is a lot going on with regard to the temperature standard. There's an EPA regional initiative, and Mike can tell you in more detail about that. I know our department has a triennial review of water quality standards. We're in a triennial review right now, and I think we're talking about temperature, and we'd be amazed if we weren't. So I think it will continue to be a dialogue. The data will get better. The information will get better. I think we will know more, and everybody who's participating in the dialogue will know more. And that's our goal. We have tried to establish what we refer to as an adaptive management approach to these TMDLs, particularly with regard to temperature, rather than looking at absolute numbers, but let's see over time what we can really do here and adjust accordingly. But I understand what you're saying, and we're happy to respond as much as anybody wants to if this issue hasn't been so consuming for you already.
Well, and I'm not sure that we maybe haven't beat this thing into the ground several times over already. Representative Krieger.
We may have beat it into the ground, but is it going to get us into a process that works? Talk about it forever, but historically we know some of those streams never met the standard. Probably Chetco, I mentioned that before, come out this summer 72 degrees out of the wilderness area, way over. Fish have adapted to it. Do we have, I wasn't at those hearings, you know, that you're referring to, the Salmon Committee. But what was the foundation of the history of the science that they knew certain stream segments were such and such a degree? In other words, have we got streams that for 60 or 70 years wouldn't have met that standard? Do we actually know that by temperatures?
Madam Chair and Representative Krieger, I'm going to let Mike get into the detail. I was not in the water program at the time that the 303D listings were done for temperature. I do know that the data were gathered from a variety of sources, and some were better than others, and some were more detailed than others. But I don't know if you want to specifically get into that a little bit, even though you weren't, I don't think, at the water program at that time. But take a shot at
it. Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, I think the point that you just made has been one of the fundamental debates that has, not necessarily a debate, but it's been one of the difficult communication issues around the temperature standard. The standard itself was developed over about a 3 to 4 year period where we, DEQ, brought together a technical advisory committee that was comprised of quite a few fish biologists, and it was really a focus on what's the temperature needs of the fish, distinguishing that from the achievability of the ultimate standard that's adopted. The achievability issue goes to your point, which is even if we adopt 64 degrees or 68 degrees, is that achievable in any particular water body in the state of Oregon? A lot of times the data collection that we try to use to verify that question comes out of the TMDL process, because once we get into a basin that's been listed for temperature, we do exponentially more sampling along with watershed councils or other partners to identify what the actual temperature profile of those particular streams is now, and to the degree that scientifically we can distinguish whether or not that is a natural condition or not, that's where we try to parse all of that information out. One example I can give you is in the Grand Ronde TMDL, is once we went through that process, we determined, at least through modeling, that we don't believe that the lower end of the Grand Ronde system can ever, in fact, meet 64 degrees. We believe that the upper end of the Grand Ronde system, once we have some watershed restoration activities there, can, in fact, meet 64 degrees. We won't know, obviously, until things happen on the ground. But we're pretty sure now, based on more data collection, that the lower end will not meet 64 degrees. And we put that into the TMDL document that we've submitted to EPA and the National Marine Fisheries Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, is to say that based on refinement of the TMDL program, we can't meet 68 degrees. The other quick thing I might say is that in southeastern Oregon, we're also looking at what's called a use attainability analysis, because of the species of fish in that area of the state. There's a lot of scientific information that would show that they are more temperature tolerant naturally than anadromous salmonids. And so we're very close to going back to our triennial Water Quality Standards Review Committee, as well as EPA and the services, to make an argument that a higher temperature threshold can be promulgated for that part of the state because of the science behind that evaluation. So I think the long and short of it is that the debate around the temperature standard is ongoing. There's people on both sides of the issue who feel that the numbers that are promulgated are either too high or too low, and we're just trying to stay the course and get these TMDLs done and see what the actual impact of the TMDL program is on temperature profiles in the streams, and then make adjustments as necessary.
With regard to the Willamette, we're on a real short time frame to do TMDLs there, and I know that in the last budgeting cycle, there was extra money put in that direction so that extra people could be put on. Is that program on track, on time, where it should be?
Madam Chair, yes, I believe it is, and we are asking for the continuation in this budget of those eight folks that were specifically allocated and general fund last session to continue that work. Do you have any more specifics on the Willamette at this point?
Madam Chair, I would say that just based on my personal knowledge of TMDLs around the country and what we've done here in Oregon, that the challenge to do a TMDL for nine of the sub-12 sub-basins in the Willamette in the next 3 years is a huge challenge. Not only just the technical work that has to be done, but as you can imagine, the public process of getting all of the impacted stakeholders to the table to figure out from a public policy standpoint how are we going to carve up the assimilative capacity on the Willamette. But we are moving ahead as fast as we can. Stephanie just kicked off the first meeting of the advisory group that will be working with us on these allocation processes. So we're optimistic that we can get the job done. I'm sure that there will be folks who will say that the data that we have in front of us today may not fill in all of the gaps, that some people would have more comfort level if there was more information to do these types of TMDLs. But given the time frame that we have, we'll make the best use of the information possible.
This summer you did an informational tour on the lower Willamette and took a number of legislators down the river and kind of showed us some of the problems that you were facing, not only in the TMDL program, but relating to the harbor and some other things that are going on there. And I was really struck with the complexity of the situation. And that was, I think, when it came really clear to me that there is virtually no way that we're going to do this on time. It's just too complex when you think from the very far reaches of the drainage all the way down to the Columbia River and, you know, the amount of just the incredible amount of land that it covers and the incredible complexity of the uses on the land and the expectation of all those people that load it. I mean, we're not talking about something that is, I don't think, realistically going to be completed in 2 years in any way, shape, or form that would reflect fairly the complexity of the situation. What happens when we don't do this on time?
Well, Madam Chair, I'll let Mike step in, but I want to say two things. One is, on any given morning at 3 a.m., I have shared those concerns. But if we go there in the water program, we will be overwhelmed. You know, you just can't think about that. You have to think we're just going to keep working at this and do the best we can and just tick them off as we do it and do the best work we can. And so that's where I try and stay focused at 3 a.m. is somehow we'll get there. That said, in theory, if we can't do it, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency can just assign loads. You know, they can do it. Up till now, and I have no reason to think this will change, they have not shown a desire to step in and do that. They have tried to be supportive. They have tried to be flexible, if you will, in terms of taking, and Mike can give some of the specifics about how when we send a TMDL in that may have some very specific load allocations for point sources, and then it'll include a plan developed under Senate Bill 1010 for agricultural practices that might be a little less precise, and maybe the Forest Practices Act that might or might not be a little less precise, but they take all that, and they have approved TMDLs that includes that package. So I don't think they are particularly excited about a scenario where they have to leap into the state and start setting numbers on these rivers. And so we will keep slogging away at it, hopefully coming up with some creative approaches to work through it, getting help from them. And one thing I can't remember, is Willamette under the court order? Or is it?
Yes.
It is. We're also under a court order to get the Willamette done, which so that EPA may not be the only factor in this matter. But I think my answer to you is we are working as hard as we can and doing the most we can at this point. And I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
The only thing I might add, Madam Chair, is that we are just a couple of thoughts. One is that we're not trying to tackle all the water quality problems of the Willamette under the TMDL program. It's very focused on the segments of the Willamette that are listed on the 303D list. And if my memory serves me, I believe it's about 11% of the stream miles of the entire Willamette Basin are actually subject to the TMDL. It's not every stream mile. We also, from a work planning standpoint, are trying to stay true to the Oregon Plan approach, where we're dealing with the sub-basins through the watershed councils. An example might be the Yamhill sub-basin. And then having another group of folks talk about the main stem of the Willamette, because I think that a lot of the sub-basin work is going to be more associated with temperature and non-point source types of impacts, whereas the main stem of the Willamette will be where we'll get more of the large industries and large municipalities. So I think that the work that we've already done in other parts of the state, we're pretty much up to speed on how to do temperature TMDLs related to the non-point source world, and I think those can go a little bit more quickly. The harder challenge will be the main stem, where we've got a lot of the municipalities and industries. So we're trying to break it into logical units to work through this process.
Well, there appears to be a lot of nervousness, too, about the budgeting process from, you know, the downstream people are nervous that they aren't going to get enough to meet their needs. the upstream people in ag and forestry are nervous that the downstream people are going to take all the capacity and they're not going to end up with any. How is this all balanced out? Because the budgets have to be for the whole drainage.
Madam Chair, that is really when I refer to the public policy part of the TMDL world, that's exactly what I'm getting at. I think the technical work that we can do in modeling provides information to the stakeholders to say, here's what the assimilative capacity of the Willamette is. Now, the public policy issue is how do we equitably distribute that allowable load between industry and municipalities, you know, upstream, downstream, and all of that. I mean, ultimately, we have to make that decision if the stakeholder group can't do that. But the reason we bring together watershed councils and this newly formed council on the Willamette is to put that very issue in front of the people who are impacted by the decision. And maybe it's naive, but we're trying to get them to make that decision, or at least that recommendation for us, rather than us impose it on them.
Well, Madam Chair, I was going to move to groundwater.
Well, I think we should.
Do you just want to stop?
We have only 5 minutes left, so we're going to get just far enough into it that we're going to have to start all over again tomorrow anyway. And I apologize for the lateness of this meeting starting. We got involved in a long floor session. And
there were some long-winded people.
We were today. But now I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Rocco for a few minutes. We find it necessary to adjust our schedule.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to point out that we've extended the time that you can ask questions to the Department of Environmental Quality for another week, so you don't need to feel rushed about this, because we're just going to move the remaining schedule forward a week. We anticipate public testimony to be on Wednesday, April 4th, on the DEQ budget, and I think that will give the committee ample time to finish up with water quality, the waste management cleanup program, agency management, the bonding programs, and other issues of the agency.
Representative Nolan? No? You look like you're really working. No further business before the committee today. I will adjourn the meeting, and we will reconvene tomorrow, hopefully at 1:00.